Spirit Blade Underground, episode 461. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 451.
Hello and welcome to the monitor room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm still Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, my review of the Wonder Woman movie, as well as my wish list for E3 2017. Some that I think are realistic and some that are probably not. All that I think are at least in the sense that all things are possible with God. I think there are some that are still possible. And then also we're going to get a Star Wars audiobook review by Katja from the Netherlands. Plus, I'm going to talk a little bit about why being a feeling geek, quote-unquote, is important as we continue making our way through the book of Ephesians. Okay, lots to do. Let's get to it. My father once told me that I could use my powers to make a difference. He told me I had a responsibility to help others. He told me I could save this world. Save everyone. Then he told me, walk the gerbil, walk the gerbil. Frickin' weirdo. Wonder Woman, a movie we've, at least I've been waiting for a long time to see what they were going to do with this character. We got to see a little bit of how they were handling her in Batman vs. Superman. But this one, she's carrying it all by herself. The IMDb synopsis reads, before she was Wonder Woman, she was Diana, princess of the Amazons, trained warrior. When a pilot crashes and tells of conflict in the outside world, she leaves home to fight a war to end all wars, discovering her full powers and true destiny. All right, so this is an origin story, so it's not wall-to-wall action, as we're kind of getting to know who she is, where she comes from, what her powers are, all that kind of stuff, and she's developing her powers over time, so, you know, it's about the halfway point before of the movie, before I think she kind of is full-on in costume being Wonder Woman, you know? As she grows in her power, the spectacle of the action gets bigger and bigger, but, I mean, it's not wall-to-wall action from beginning to end. There are lots of interesting characters that surround Diana, which I thought was really good. Let's see what else. Oh, yeah. I would put this tonally between Marvel, the average Marvel movie, and Man of Steel / Batman versus Superman. I don't bring this up to keep harping on it, but just in case you're not familiar with my reviews and my tastes, I'm not a fan of most of the Marvel movies, largely because I don't find the witty banter to be funny or interesting. It kind of like repeatedly takes me out of my investment in the story. I had some concerns when I saw the trailer. I was like, well, I think what I'm seeing in the trailer of the, you know, the trailer jokes are kind of funny, but I mean, are they going to be going for lots of jokes? Is this going to be an experience for me that's kind of disappointing and you know, in the same way that the Marvel movies are for me. It's largely a serious movie, and it's even heavy at times. It uses the backdrop of World War I, I think really effectively, to show the brokenness of the human condition. You know, there is violence, there is cruelty. We don't have a right relationship with animals. We don't have a right relationship with each other. We have issues of bigotry and selfishness and cruelty and prejudice. And selfishness. And it lets the audience sit in the darkness of war for a few minutes now and then as we see through Diana's eyes people coming off of the battlefield with like missing limbs and children that are, you know, we hear about women and children that are being victimized and, you know, so it really brings the darkness of war as, you know, to the same degree I think that you would find in some war movies, albeit briefly, into this story. And I think that's, for my tastes, that's a really good thing. I realize that for me, I love superhero stories specifically not for scratching my power fantasy itch. I think maybe that was a thing for me at one time. But now, I mean, for a long time now, I just play video games if I want to feel, you know, simulate being more capable or having superpowers or something like that. That's really not what I go to superhero movies or superhero TV shows for. I mean, that's kind of like icing on the cake, but it's not really what is going to keep me interested and invested in a superhero story. Really, I'm going to stay invested in a superhero story that scratches my savior itch, if I can call it that. I love it when a hero can come along in a story to make the wrong things right. And that moment is more powerful, or actually has any power at all, only when I feel how wrong things are. So if we really quickly in superhero stories try to break up the tension with jokes, I don't get to sit in that place of feeling the evil and the wrongs that are being committed against people. And so getting relief from those wrongs doesn't really do anything for me. So I prefer superhero stories that feel heavy and hopeless for a while, because then I feel the victory so much more. And this movie really gave me that. Now, having said that, there are still many more frequent jokes in this movie than in, say, Man of Steel or Batman vs. Superman. I would put it, in terms of its frequency of jokes, somewhere between the X-Men movies and the X-Men universe movies and the average Marvel movie. The difference here is that the jokes are not the way I kind of feel like they are in the Marvel movies, kind of like a one-size-fits-all witty banter, but they're tailored in this movie to the character. So Etta Candy is Steve Trevor's secretary, and she's a, you know, this insecure, you know, woman who's also trying to be very proper, you know, and so her jokes and her awkwardness, all her humorous moments come out of those attributes. And Steve Trevor is heroic, but he's also big time a fish out of water, and so those are the kinds of jokes you're going to see from him, and they're saying something about his character, you know. Diana, her humorous moments are largely about being oblivious to how she's coming across, so she's a fish out of water in a different way. The jokes also depend very much, I think, on the actor's performances. You can have these kind of character-tailored jokes in other scripts as well, but, you know, if the actors aren't bringing some of that, you know, performance magic to it, it's not going to connect with me as much. I'm probably not going to laugh as much. But if the actors are bringing like extra layers of subtlety or subtext to the jokes, then I'm much more likely to get a laugh out of it than say like simply a straight dry delivery that really just depends on the script itself or the punchline. You know, like, well, we're fighting you know, so it's just these little like thrown off, you know, kind of witty banter. They're delivered pretty straight, and they're not unique and tailored to each character. And I think that's what I'm figuring out. It tickles my funny bone more in like superhero types of stories, if it's tailored more to the characters and is an outworking of who they are in both the script and in the way those moments are performed. And I'm also drawn in much more by actor performance than dialogue in general. So this whole approach really worked well for me. I was surprised that I actually chuckled often during this movie. That was unusual for me. I also kind of have to tip my hat at the movie for handling romance and sex in what I thought was a fairly classy way, especially for Hollywood. That may be because they were, you know, it was being directed by a woman from more of a woman's point of view, maybe for a little bit more of a female audience, and so the emphasis was less on just physical attraction and more on kind of like budding romance and like getting to know a person and the affection and the chemistry that you can develop as you get to know who a person is. There was a scene, you know, where Steve Trevor is taking a bath and Wonder Woman kind of walks in on him, and so there's the gag of him being naked and embarrassed and stuff like that. But it wasn't really phasing Wonder Woman at all, you know? She was starting to kind of fall for Steve Trevor later on in the movie. She was getting to know him more. And that's another thing I really appreciated about how they depicted, you know, the kind of like iconic, strong female character. I mean, that's kind of what Wonder Woman is, you know? Is just kind of like, if there's going to be a strong female character, then Wonder Woman should represent, you know, she should be the mold, you know, that they're based on. And I felt like they did a really good job with that, because she was strong and ready to go to battle. And then like just a few seconds later in one scene where she's talking about, we've got to go to battle or whatever, whatever the line was. She had this furrowed brow, you know. And then she looks over and sees a woman kind of nursing or taking care of a baby at the, on the side of the street. And she goes, oh, a baby, you know. And she goes over and she just, that maternal instinct, she just wants to go over and see this baby, you know. And she finds, you know, even though she's much more capable than Steve and she's not really impressed by his, you know, his physique and stuff like that, she gets to know who he is and is still charmed by him, you know. And I don't want to say swept off her feet, but I mean, you know, it's, she still is very much, you know, she has a softness to her in addition to her strength, which is wonderful. I think if you, if all you do is just make her like hard and angry and stuff like that, then, you know, you lose some of, I think, the wonderful characteristics that women can have, you know, just that, what else was there? Oh, and she also found one of the characters in the supporting cast. She really enjoyed his singing of all things. And it just brought a softness and a smile to her face that was really endearing to me. So I just thought they got this wonderful mix of strength and confidence and assertiveness and capability, and at the same time, softness and compassion and affection and sweetness, you know. That was wonderful. That was wonderful. I did not expect that. I was very happy with that. And then also there was a scene that kind of represented the high point of the romance between Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor, where they end the night going into her room, and he kind of is about to leave and then kind of senses from her look that maybe she wants him to stay, and so he closes the door behind him, and they come and get close together. They might have kissed. I can't actually remember if they did or not, but very quickly after they got close together, they cut to a picture of the outside of the building at night with the light in the room on. The light stays on, and then they cut away. So, sure, we can assume that they slept together. We certainly don't have to. You know, maybe it was just like a sweet romantic exploration, the first explorations of the physical aspects of romance that happened that night. We don't know, you know? And I think I really appreciate that being left to the imagination, and there was no, like, morning after kind of hints at what happened the night before. It was just the next morning they move on. And so I really appreciate that. I think it's classy. I think it's more romantic. And I think, honestly, I think it values human love, romantic love, much more than just like taking us to a slow motion, bow chicka bow, steamy sex scene. All right. So I'm not going to talk about the cast a whole bunch. I thought that Gal Gadot carried her weight much better than I thought she might. I can't see her, I don't think, is very versatile. I've seen her in a few movies right now. Maybe she'll surprise me in the future. But for me, she is now, I think, a valid choice for one particular take on Wonder Woman, in my opinion, and for my tastes of who Wonder Woman is. Even if this isn't exactly the version of Wonder Woman that, say, I might put on the screen. I have some different character traits and personality things and stuff that I would have liked to have seen, just because I think of this thing in my head as the iconic Wonder Woman, not necessarily what Gal Gadot is doing up there, but I do still think it's a valid take. And thankfully with superhero movies, I think if we've been reading comics for years, we ought to be open to multiple takes on these characters because they keep getting reimagined and reinterpreted over and over again. Let's see, as mentioned before, the rest of the cast I thought does a great job of adding depth to the script and to their characters by the way they interpret and then perform their roles. Although Gal Gadot was solid for me, I felt like, I'm really glad she had an enjoyable and engaging supporting cast to help carry the movie with her. I think that was probably important and probably will be important for future Wonder Woman movies. As far as stunts and visuals, lots of high-flying, crazy, slow-mo action, but my cursed CG detecting eyes certainly detected a lot of CG actor replacement. And then also now and then, and I have to be honest, it was because I just was kind of looking for it, I could detect stunt double replacement for Gadot because of just a little bit more muscle tone on her arms. And then just in general, a greater command over her own body movements during running or other types of action. I was like, oh yeah, that's not Gal Gadot right there. And you know, and also suspicions are aroused when you can't see her face, her hair is blocking, you know, and stuff. There's not as much spectacle in this movie as, say, Man of Steel or Batman vs. Superman, but still plenty. And I think even for my cursed eyes, on a second viewing, I'll be able to just kind of relax a little more and just accept the pictures that the director's wanting to show me rather than seeing all the things they're trying to hide. Okay, normally at this point, I would talk about the philosophical or spiritual or moral themes that might come to mind as a result of watching this movie. I'm actually going to wait and do that till after my closing thoughts. I'm not planning on giving any spoilers, but I do think that even speaking vaguely about the themes that stuck out to me, which came out to me really strongly, could potentially show the plot's hand a little bit more than you might want to going into the movie. So if you want to go in completely, you know, without risk of kind of seeing where things are going in the story, then maybe avoid my thoughts on the relevance of the movie. But just to, you know, to give my summary on, you know, how I enjoyed the movie, what it was like for me. Well, I have no idea, you know, what your tastes are, of course. But if I were a time traveler, I'd go back in time and say, Peter, dude, go see this with Holly. You guys are going to have a great time watching it together. You're going to have a great conversation on the way home. This is the third DC movie to have some Christ imagery that you will find powerfully moving. And then just plan on buying this one the day it comes to Blu-ray. This is totally your kind of movie and definitely your kind of superhero movie. It's not quite as much your cup of tea as, say, Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman, because it doesn't go totally cut loose in terms of spectacle and totally go as heavy as it could in the heaviness of the drama and subject matter, but real close, and will probably even have appeal for some of your friends and who didn't like those other DC movies. So don't miss this one, don't miss seeing it, and don't miss buying it. All right, it's rated PG-13 for sequences of violence and action and some suggestive content. All right, so now my vague but potentially spoilery thoughts on the themes of this movie. A major theme of this movie is that humanity is broken. And broken not because we are the victims of culture or some manipulating power, but because we just choose evil. That's our choice. It's our responsibility. And Diana, Wonder Woman, resists helping humanity when she realizes this, because before she leaves the island, her mother says, "They don't deserve your help, Diana." You know, and she went anyway. And then when she kind of realized, wow, they are not the way they are because they're being manipulated. They are choosing. So many of these humans are choosing evil. And so she's like, my mother was right. Humanity does not deserve my help. And Steve Trevor tells her that it's not about deserving it. It's not about deserving it. It's about what you believe. And when he says that, I was like, okay, well, if you don't fill in that gap, then it's just the same empty pop spirituality that doesn't actually come out and say anything meaningful. It just says, just believe in belief and have faith in faith. Well, what the crap does that mean? I don't know. So when he said that, I was like, okay, well, if it's all about what you believe, then what should you believe? And there was kind of a tension. I was like, I mean, are they going to say something that's worthwhile here? Or are they just going to leave it at that? Or are they going to plug something in there that's totally wrong or whatever? You know, like, I believe that humanity can rise up and they can be better and they can put aside, you know, for good, all of their evil and stuff like that. You know, I thought it might go that way. It doesn't go that way, which was really gratifying to me, to just, let's recognize, let's be real with ourselves about the real state of humanity. What she says, Ares, you know, basically tells her that humanity's corrupt, not deserving of help. And this is kind of, I'm not going to say anything about where this falls in the movie. But she basically says, you're right. They are all that you say, but so much more. And indicating there that there is great value in that. And she, you know, she recognizes it's not about deserving. She even kind of repeats what Steve said to Ares. She said, it's not about deserving. It's about what you believe. And then she adds, and I believe in love. And that's kind of vague. You know, that could mean a lot. I believe in, you know, people, you know, have the ability to, I don't think that logically it would make sense for her to be meaning in her mind, I believe in humanity's ability to love instead of doing evil, because she confesses it's not about deserving. It's not about them potentially deserving to be rescued. She says they are all those things, but I believe in love. So what does that mean? Well, I don't know what it meant to the filmmakers, but as I plug in my biblical worldview to that, I see that we have value, intrinsic value as humans, even when we do not exercise our capacity for love. So I don't think she's talking about they have capacity for love necessarily. But we do have that capacity, and that gives us intrinsic worth. And I would say it gives us intrinsic worth because that capacity is a reflection of who God is. We are able to love in a way that no other created thing can love. And we are even more than that. We are loved by God in a way that no other created thing is loved, because God made us in some way to reflect who he is. He put his image, his stamp in some way on top of us. And then even when we rejected him and said, hey, thanks for making us to reflect the most amazing being in all of the in all of existence, but we don't really want anything to do with you. Even when we did that, he still chose to become one of us, live among us, be rejected by us, be humiliated publicly by us, be mistreated by us, be suffer horribly and emotionally and physically, and then die a torturous death, all so that we could be reconciled to him forever. So it's because of love, that not because we deserve it, that Christ became our rescuer. And that's why I think it's just, whether it's intended partially or not intended at all, I think that Wonder Woman in this movie was just a beautiful mirror of Christ, and also a reminder of what Christ modeled for us, that Wonder Woman now models for us. And that is that people are worth investing in. You know, as geeks, it's so easy for us to want to just kind of go off in our hole because we've been hurt by people, or people take a lot of work, they take a lot of energy. It's much easier to just kind of be in our hermit hole and do our own thing and not schedule time and invest time in relationships that might be kind of difficult. We can just say to ourselves, that person doesn't deserve another chance with me, you know, but it's not about what they deserve. God gave us what we didn't deserve. That's called grace, undeserved favor. That's what grace means. And so that's what Jesus models for us, and what Wonder Woman imitates in Jesus and models for us, and what we are meant to model as well. So for that reason, and many more, I really enjoyed this movie. So those are my thoughts. I want to remind you guys to check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POSTOS, Helix Reviews, and the Retro Rewind podcast. I don't think I can do that all in one breath anymore, guys. But for more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Hey all, this is Katja from the Netherlands, Comicate on the Christian Geek Central forums. Today I'm sharing another audiobook short, a series of very concise reviews of the audiobooks I have finished. This audiobook short is about A Rule of Two, which is part two of the Darth Bane trilogy, a Star Wars novel from the so-called Expanded Universe. It is written by Drew Karpyshyn and narrated by Jonathan Davis. As always, I will start this review with the publisher's summary, which says, in the New York Times bestseller Darth Bane Path of Destruction, Drew Karpyshyn painted a gripping portrait of a young man's journey from innocence to evil. That man was Darth Bane, a twisted genius whose iron will, fierce ambition, and strength in the dark side of the Force made him a natural leader among the Sith, until his radical embrace of an all-but-forgotten wisdom drove him to destroy his own order and created anew from the ashes. As the last surviving Sith, Darth Bane promulgated a harsh new directive, the Rule of Two. Two there should be, no more, no less, one to embody the power, the other to create it. Now Darth Bane is ready to put his policy into action, and he thinks he has found the key element that will make his triumph complete, a student to train in the ways of the dark side. Though she is young, Xana possesses an instinctive link to the dark side that rivals his own. With his guidance, she will become essential in his quest to destroy the Jedi and dominate the galaxy. But there is one who is determined to stop Darth Bane, Johann Othone, Padawan to Jedi Master Lord Hoth, who died at Bane's hands in the last great Sith War. Though the rest of the Jedi scoff at him, Joshua's belief that there are surviving Sith on the loose is unshakable. As Johann continues his dogged pursuit of the man who killed his master, Xana, faced unexpectedly with a figure from her past, begins to question her embrace of the dark side. And Darth Bane is led by Force-induced visions to a moon where he will acquire astonishing new knowledge and power, power that will alter him in ways he could never have imagined. As for my thoughts on this novel, I started listening to it right after I finished Path of Destruction, for that first part of the Darth Bane trilogy left me wanting for more. And more is exactly what I got with Rule of Two. I found it even more gripping, it was even better paced, and narrator Jonathan Davis gives a truly masterful performance. Following Darth Bane as a full-blown Dark Lord of the Sith was a thrilling ride, especially since he now has an equally intriguing apprentice in Zanna, a young woman strong in the dark side, whom Bane teaches a lot, but who also has a unique talent of her own, Dark Force magic. As with the first part of this Darth Bane trilogy, I was so completely wrapped up in the story I could only sit on the couch listening, doing nothing else. I mean, come on, the audiobook format was supposed to let me multitask. But that was simply not going to fly, and on the couch I stayed. Unfortunately, I finished this novel far too soon, and again I found myself wanting still more. Fortunately, there's a third part. So, again, maybe boring, but still, 5 stars for performance, 5 stars for the story, and 5 stars overall. So, more about the third part next time. Thank you for listening, stay geeky, and tot de volgende keer. Doei!
Data collection complete. Activating MusaNet 1.0.
This week at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, you can get part two of my video series on the themes of Horizon Zero Dawn, which is a very popular game that came out recently for the PlayStation 4. If you are planning on playing it and don't want the story spoiled for you, then these are videos that you do want to wait on until after you've played through the game. But if you've played through the game already or you don't mind the spoilers, then my intent is to just kind of take a dive as best I can based on what I experienced of the game in looking at the themes of the game, and specifically just kind of the truth claims that it seems to be either directly making or indirectly supporting through the choices that it makes in the actual content of the story and just the way that it tells its story. So this time, in part two, I'm looking at the themes of justice, redemption, which those two are very closely related, and then also life's value, specifically the value of human life. There was moments in the game that seemed to be playing with those themes and making statements about those things, both intentionally and unintentionally. So anyway, if that sounds interesting to you, you can check that out at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. And while you're there, if you want to like, share, or subscribe, that's a nice way to help to grow that channel and overall the Christian Geek Central community. I'd love to, as that channel grows, steer people more and more to engaging on a deeper level with you and I the forums and at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Always really enjoy just kind of hearing what's on your mind and interacting with you guys there. So if you've never done that before, I highly recommend introducing yourself there. You're certainly welcome to just kind of lurk and listen in on the conversations and read the conversations. I guess you don't listen to forums unless you've got one of those handy dandy programs. Maybe you do listen. I don't know what I'm talking about. But anyway, if you've never introduced yourself at the forums yet, I want to encourage you to do that. I love finding out, who's out there and what they're interested in. That's one of my favorite things to do is when a new person introduces themselves, I'm like, oh, cool, welcome. Tell us what you're into. What kind of geeky stuff are you into? So we can just kind of celebrate that together and have fun and see what else comes of that as we just kind of experience what little bit of life we can through a kind of a limited text format. But anyway, I really appreciate interacting with you guys there. So if you haven't, again, introduce yourself, please. What else? Oh, yeah. Okay, I got to be quiet now. Although my wife is sleeping, so there's like a very, very little chance she would hear me say this. But anyway, I've not been doing a very good job of celebrating the 10th anniversary of Spirit Blade Productions. It kind of came and went and was kind of covered up by the release of Spirit Blade: World of Shadows, capping off that trilogy, which was kind of a fitting way to celebrate the 10-year anniversary. And I did a couple, sales and stuff like that. But before this year is over, in which I'm kind of recognizing and celebrating 10 years of me doing Spirit Blade Productions, I really want, as a part of that, for my wife to hear from those of you for whom Spirit Blade Productions or Christian Geek Central has meant something special, because the only way I'm able to do what I'm doing is because my wife is working to pay the bills. What I'm doing through Christian Geek Central and Spirit Blade Productions and giving the time that I am to it, I knew going into this ministry that it was, you know, and we organize it as an LLC. I've only in more recent years been calling it a ministry because, just because that might be confusing to people, like, well, you're not a nonprofit. Well, no, because there's just kind of like some hassles and things I didn't want to have to deal with, that would unnecessarily complicate things by trying to, make it a nonprofit. So LLC was the easiest route. But anyway, regardless of how the U.S. government and their laws sees what I'm doing, I've always viewed this as a ministry and recognized almost from the get-go that, you know, this is for a niche group. This is for, you know, the folks that maybe kind of slipped through the cracks a bit. And so, you know, in terms of the local church, because the local church, and I support their decision to do this, the local church in many cases is trying to reach out to people when they're trying to reach out based on common interests, they're going to go for what is most popular. So they're more likely to throw a Super Bowl party than they are, you know, like a board game party. You know, and I think that makes a lot of sense, you know. But even so, I just saw this potential need to kind of connect and do ministry with those that kind of slip through the cracks of the church and try to steer them back to the local church and to see the benefits and the great things about being involved in Christian community. And hopefully that's something you guys have been hearing from me, is steering you again and again to the local church, as broken and dysfunctional as it certainly can be. It is just God's instrument on earth. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. That's a rabbit trail. All that to say, because this ministry is to such a niche crowd, it's not really, it can't really be financially successful based upon, you know, like playing the numbers game, you know, like ads or something like that, because I'm just not going to get the kind of clicks and views and stuff like that that just a mainstream, like video game type of, you know, outlet or something like that would do. It's just, it's a niche within a niche within a niche within a niche, you know. And so Holly, my wife, is the only reason I'm able to dedicate nearly my full time to what I'm doing. The rest of the time I take care of things around the house, and I do things for the boys, and just kind of like, you know, just general kind of life stuff to keep the family functioning. So if something were to happen and, you know, Holly just tomorrow couldn't work anymore for whatever reason, then that would be instantly pretty much the end of Spirit Blade Productions. And so I'm so continually grateful to her for that. And I don't ever want to take her for granted. And anyway, I just wanted to call for those of you who for whom Spirit Blade Productions or Christian Geek Central has meant something special, to express your thanks to my wife Holly. And you can do that by sending me an email to my address, but please address all of your writing to her. But you can send that to PAETER@spiritblade.com, and then the deadline for that is Sunday, June 25th. So we are in June now. And then I'm going to collect all those and give them all to her at once. I've heard from, two or three of you so far, and it's been great to hear from you. I would love as much as possible to just inundate her with, thoughts and thanks from as many people as would like to do that. So, once again, PAETER@spiritblade.com is where you can send that. And the deadline again is Sunday, June 25th. All right. That's it for that. Let's keep going. Okay, guys, just a quick note about this segment of the podcast. This is audio taken from the video version of this, which you should be able to check out at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral now. And there's several points at which I kind of say this or this. Sorry, I gotta say, you know, I'm talking about how I would prefer to use a gamepad over a mouse. And so when I talk negatively about something called this, I don't want to do this, then I'm using a gesture that looks like me operating a mouse. And when I say I'd rather do this, then I'm doing a gesture that involves me like miming a using a gamepad. And I didn't really think about how that audio would translate. I will try to create content in the future that will work both as video and audio. So sorry about the confusion and the need for this little interruption here. But there you go. Hope you enjoy. E3 2017 is what, just over like a week and a half away, and there is so much potential for big announcements, surprises, disappointments. I thought I would share my wish list for the big gaming publicity event, and then near the end, some wishes from those of you on our forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Now, I want to be clear, these are wishes, because I'm not in the know enough to make predictions. But, you know, despite the fact that some I think are realistic and some are just ridiculous fantasies, I don't rule out any of them because I think they're all at least remotely possible. After all, some of my wishes from previous wish lists of E3 have actually come true. So let's get into my wishes for this year's E3. First, I want short wait times. The space between a game's announcement and its release, I prefer to be as short as possible, 6 months or less. Is really my preference. And if it's going to be 18 months or more, like a year and a half or more, wait until next E3 to tell us about it. I don't want to hear about it until then. I'd prefer to have like no CG trailers without gameplay footage right on its heels. If it's just a CG trailer all by itself, I don't know what this game is. I don't know how it's going to play. I don't know what this experience is going to be or if I should even get excited about it, whether or not it's my type of game. I don't know any of that. So really give me gameplay and show me what these games are, especially if you're going to deliver a CG trailer. Follow that right up with gameplay footage. I always love it when video game companies show some transparency. And just some integrity, you know, when they acknowledge maybe some missteps of the past. Sometimes that's done in a very subtle way because they don't want to really kind of admit defeat. But I think the more they can go in the direction of transparency and just acknowledging some missteps, I think goes a long way toward gaining credibility with their fans. And then also just integrity in general in terms of like fulfilling promises that were made in the past, you know. And I know it's not always possible, and hopefully going forward, what we'll see is they, you know, make fewer promises that they're not absolutely confident that they can keep. So in general, I guess what I'm asking for there is just being real with us. And I know that's really hard from a marketing standpoint, and it's not always the most practical choice, but it's something that I really appreciate. I'd love to see more experiences in general that will entice core gamers to spend time with others actually in person, you know, couch co-op, or if you could somehow figure out the magic of making a party game that will appeal to both casual and core gamers at the same time. But I would love to just see a return to this kind of in-person social gaming. I think real in-person relationships are so important, especially as Christians. That's something we really want to be investing in. And so to have games that encourage not just online play, but in-person, in the same room, hospitality, inviting people over to your home and having them in the same living space with you for a little while to hang out and play games, that's huge relationally. And so I'd love to see more experiences that will kind of create an opportunity for that. I'd love to see game stories that validate the worth of human life and relationships, but without catering to those who would maybe be seeking their identity and self-validation in games. And I guess what I mean by that is diversity for diversity's sake would be one major example. Diversity is great in a game that is set in something like our real world, as it kind of represents the diversity of people types and ethnic groups that we experience. And so it makes the game kind of more realistic and relatable in that sense. But I think for us to go beyond that and say, I want my demographic, however I define myself, you know, to be represented positively in a game, I think is to look for something in games that games should not be expected to give us, and that is validation of our self-worth. Our value comes from the fact that God made us to in some way reflect who He is, and then He became one of us and suffered in life and died horribly in order to rescue us from an eternal death separated from Him. That's what gives us our immense worth. I don't think this will be necessarily a problem this year, but I always like it when companies avoid gimmicks and trend chasing, whether that's motion, you know, control technology or VR, something like that. I'd love to just kind of see those kinds of gimmicks downplayed as much as possible. If they want to, you know, show briefly kind of what they're working on, that's fine. They gotta, they have to push the technology forward, I suppose. I just don't like a lot of time to be spent there. Once again, I just would love entertainment, you know, well-crafted shows, surprises, and or these kind of outrageous, audacious moments and quotes, you know, shocking. But I'm not looking for like jabbing of other companies or kind of an arrogance or, and I certainly don't wish like failure or humiliation on any of these guys, despite the fact that they can sometimes come off as like slick used car salesmen. They are, I think, out of their element when they're getting in front of these crowds and, trying to talk and these are businessmen, you know, and so a lot of these guys, especially like the developers getting out front, they are out of their element. And so I feel sympathy for them. So I want the shows to go well. I don't want anybody to crash and burn. And yet at the same time, it would be neat to see these kind of like really shocking, surprising, outrageous moments that we can talk about at the water cooler the next day. Now, I feel like for my taste, it's been a while since we've seen this, but I want something that is like legit cool that is said to be available now from some big stage presentation. You know, you can go and download it right now. Something that I would legitimately like to get, as opposed to kind of some artsy thing like Flow or Flying or whatever that thing was that Sony had a couple years ago. This is a recent addition to my wish list. I want an open city Terminator game. Would somebody make that? As I'm playing these open world action games so often, the mission is to just go find this person and take him out, you know? And so I'll be going around in like Saints Row games and I'll just start singing. Now, I don't know, can you sing? It's just rhythmic, but I'll be like, and I totally get my Terminator vibe on. How has that game not been made yet? To be a Terminator and just have an open city and you have these targets that you're supposed to go and take out. Somebody make that game! Finally, I want someone to spearhead a game design revolution that I'm going to call failure adaptivity. And in other words, this is where when you fail at something, instead of like going back and repeating material, like say an insta-fail stealth mission, you're spotted, start over, or falling into an eternal pit like in Mario and dying. You died, start over. Let the game world in some way react and allow you to keep going forward despite the fact that you failed at something. You know, in the real world, when I tell my wife I'm going to go to the grocery store, I should only be about an hour. Then if I fail to be back in an hour, then I don't get warped backward in time and have to do all my grocery shopping again because I fell short of hitting that 1 hour timer that was counting down. No, instead, my wife goes, "Where were you? I needed the car to go so and so." So there's some kind of change that happens. There's a reaction from the world to my failure. I want to see more of that in games instead of failure states setting us back. All right, so that was my largest category. Now we're going to get into the smaller categories that go by studio by studio or company by company. We'll start with EA. I was really disappointed with their press conference last year, so I'm hoping for something that's more engaging and like that will connect with my tastes more this year. I'd love to get a Star Wars KOTOR-like RPG, whether that's Knights of the Old Republic 3, or it's just something that is like that, this kind of like action RPG type of thing. I'm not a big Star Wars fan anymore these days, but I like sci-fi, I like laser swords, you know, I like weird magic, you know, telekinetic stuff, so I'll play that game, just make it a cool action RPG and I'm in. Single player, no MMOs, please. Now this is like a crazy long shot. I want a sequel to Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning. EA, I think, was involved as the distributor. I'm not sure, maybe the publisher, I can't remember, but they had like a big hand in getting that game out. Now that studio has shut down. I think the intellectual property is owned by the people of Maine or something crazy like that. EA, rescue that property and just keep the engine, keep everything the same, and just give us a new campaign. I mean, oh my gosh, that seems like, I don't know anything about business, but that seems like it would be, you know, a pretty good investment. You don't have to remake anything from scratch. You've got this really cool engine with a great combat system that a lot of people really enjoyed. Come on, just give us that sequel. BioWare, oh man, they got this new intellectual property that they haven't revealed yet. I just want them to make me believe again. I mean, these are the guys that made Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, that made Neverwinter Nights, that made Dragon Age Origins. I mean, these are like some of my favorite RPGs of all time. And ever since putting out Dragon Age Origins, after that, there's been like this decline for my tastes. and this move away from RPGs, almost like they're afraid to make RPGs. They're like, oh, RPGs are kind of nerdy, or people don't like RPGs. Let's make them more actiony, more like shooters. And they've just been moving more and more in kind of like the action game direction. And that's just been a real bummer for me. So I would love for the RPG lovers at BioWare to, if there are any left, to be cooking up an RPG for RPG fans. Come on, BioWare. Come back to your glory days. All right, moving on to Microsoft now. I did not get an Xbox One. I had a really frustrating experience with the hardware side of the Xbox 360. And after the fiasco of the launch of Xbox One, I was like, okay, guys, forget it. I'm totally done with Xbox, you know. But it's still possible one day they could, you know, get me back into their fold. In the meantime, I just want them to be a great competitor for Sony, because competition will make Sony better. So I just want them to be good and really appealing, but not too good, because I don't want to have to buy another console anytime soon. I love their backwards compatibility focus. I'd love for them to continue in that vein. I'd love for their show to have a really strong game focus and focus on exclusives that will actually release. They've really been having trouble with that. And I'd love to see them kind of recover from that and get some unique intellectual properties that will make their console stand out. If that doesn't work, or maybe better yet, go in with just an entirely different strategy. Last year, they talked about this kind of like bridging the gap between Xbox consoles and specifically the Xbox One and PC games. If they could somehow embrace that crossover and allow console players to experience the rich world of PC games without having to like do all the expensive upgrading, all the dumb drivers and stuff like that, just make it freaking user-friendly. And every game to be equally as easy to play and enjoy with a gamepad as it is with a keyboard and mouse. I know that the Steam controller and the Steam machines or Steam boxes or whatever they were called, I think that was an attempt by Valve to try and bring about that kind of like bridging the gap between console gamers and PC gaming. I don't feel like that really was the revolution or the bridge that we really needed. If Microsoft could somehow wow us with a way of making that a reality, that would be huge for video gaming as a whole. That would be a mammoth achievement. And who knows, maybe under the behind the curtain, they've been working on doing just that. I would love to see that big, this huge showstopper for them this year. Talking about Bethesda now. Elder Scrolls 6. I know I have no reason to expect it. I have probably many, many reasons not to expect it. But Morrowind came out in 2002, and then 3, 4, 5, 2006. 4 years later, we got Oblivion. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 5 years later, we got Skyrim in 2011. And then 12, 13, 14, if you want to count it, we got Elder Scrolls Online 3 years later. I don't count that. 15, 16, 17. So that puts us at 6 years since Skyrim now. We are overdue, by my estimate, or at the very least due, for an Elder Scrolls 6. Come on! If I can't get an Elder Scrolls 6, and I probably can't, then I will take Skyrim New Vegas. And by that I mean Fallout 3, the engine for Fallout 3, was given to Obsidian, which is an external studio to Bethesda, and they cooked up Fallout New Vegas, this entirely new full-length campaign that used basically all the same systems and gameplay as Fallout 3, but with an entirely new campaign. If I can't get Elder Scrolls 6 in 6 months, then I want an announcement that I'll get Skyrim New Vegas in 6 months, that they have given their engine to some external studio to cook up another Elder Scrolls game or another, you know, game set in the Elder Scrolls world that isn't a proper sequel, but is a full-length campaign using the same systems as Skyrim. Come on, come on! If I can't get that, then I want, you know, they got like two or three IPs that they've been working on in secret that they're maybe going to reveal. I just want one of them to be, you know, an Elder Scrolls-like open-world RPG. That would be fine, too. Finally, from Bethesda, hints and rumors seem to be pointing toward a new Wolfenstein game being released. I've really been enjoying Wolfenstein The New Order. It's a lot of fun. I'd like the sequel to be even more open and more RPG-like. Maybe like Bioshock, where your character builds his capabilities and his weapons and stuff like that over the course of the game. Whereas in The New Order, after a level, you're kind of reset and given a new, you know, starting loadout of weapons, and then you have to find the rest in the level that you're in. I'm not a big fan of that. I like developing my character consistently over time and not having the reset button hit. So even if it's not like open world, if it was like a BioShock type of level design and then a BioShock type of character progression design, that would be really cool for me in a Wolfenstein game. Moving on to Ubisoft now. I have in recent years become a big fan of Ubisoft games. I have to qualify that though, because I love the open world structure and all the things that you can do on their maps in, say, the Far Cry games. Big fan of the Far Cry games. And just recently, after kind of being curious about the world after watching the Assassin's Creed movie, I started playing through the games. I'm now like more than halfway through the third game, Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, and I'm really enjoying them, except for some of the story missions can have insta-fail conditions where it's like, don't be spotted or you gotta start over. If this person dies, you got to start over. If you don't do this in a certain amount of time, you got to start over. And I've kind of hit like a concentrated stack of missions, story missions in a row that are very much like that. Very frustrating. But apart from that, I really love these games. And so what I love is as they talk about Far Cry 5, as they talk about the new Assassin's Creed game, I'd like in some way for it to be communicated that no more insta-fail missions. That's kind of in line with my failure adaptivity concept that I'd love to see more of in games. Hey, if Ubisoft could lead the way in that, then suddenly these would become like maybe the ultimate gaming experiences for me. We know we're getting Far Cry 5 in like February of 2018, so my wish for Assassin's Creed then would be for a fall release. And by the fall, I mean October. Give it to me in time for Extra Life. On to Sony now. Once again, I would love a big, strong game focus from Sony, as opposed to talking about new hardware that they're working on or whatever. Games, games, games. Always loved more games. I wouldn't mind hearing about a sequel to Horizon Zero Dawn. I'm not done kind of collecting all the collectibles in that open world action RPG, but I'm ready to hear that they're at least working on a sequel, and I'd love to hear that the main character that you're playing as is Sylens. Oh man, that would be an interesting character and a potentially very interesting arc to follow over the course of a game. I really don't want Aloy again. She was kind of getting on my nerves. She had a chip on her shoulder pretty much the whole game that never really healed, and she just kind of positioned herself as judge, jury, and yes, even executioner. She just kind of like acted in a very superior manner. And since I can't sit down with Aloy and say, hey, what's going on, you know, and talk to her about that, I just have to listen to her, and I'm getting tired of it. So, Sylens, a new protagonist, or a changed Aloy. An Aloy that's, from the start of the game, something major happens to her that just changes her personality in some way to make her just a little more likable. Now, since 2015, I've been asking for this. I want the Snowblind action RPGs available on the PlayStation Network so that I can play them on the PlayStation 4. I probably won't be able to play them on Vita, although that would be cool. I'm talking about Baldur's Gate, Dark Alliance, Baldur's Gate, Dark Alliance 2, the Justice League Heroes RPG, and Champions of Norrath. I'll even take Champions Return to Arms. I would love to see those games on the PlayStation Network. I'd also love to see the Shadowheart series on the PlayStation Network, at least the first game in the series. It would be great to see those, even if they don't take the time to kind of up-res them and clean them up and stuff like they've been doing for those PS2 re-releases on the PlayStation Network. Even if they don't do that, I'd still love to get them as they are so that I can continue playing them, because these are games I keep going back to again and again and again. And my PlayStation 2, I've taken it apart and I have to keep tweaking it to keep it working. It needs lots of love to stay alive. It's been dying for quite a long time, and I may only have days of my PlayStation 2 left. Who knows? Of course, the best solution to that, which I've been asking for since 2015, is PlayStation 2 disc-based backwards compatibility. I really don't think they're going to do that, but I would love for them to just stick an emulator on there and let me just put my discs in and play those games to help preserve them. Like I said, these are great experiences. I want to be able to play them in the future. I can't remember if there's a release date for the new God of War game or not, but as we see more of that, I'd like to know more about what kind of game it is. Seems obvious to me it's not the same, like, beat-em-up almost that the original God of War games were, that maybe it's a little bit open world. Someone suggested to me maybe it'll be something like Horizon Zero Dawn. I would love it if it had some RPG systems so that I don't have to be really good at having quick reflexes, you know, to get through the game, that I can kind of grind my way out of trouble if I need to. So yeah, more about the systems of God of War, and I would love to discover that it's my kind of game, which is going to be more of like an action RPG type of experience. This is a long shot. I know it's been advertised as like coming exclusively to Xbox One for console players, but I would love to see Path of Exile coming to PlayStation 4, or at least word that, you know, now that it's coming to Xbox One, yes, it will also be coming to PlayStation 4. That seems like a really logical choice to me. If you make it for one console, you ought to be able to put it on the other. So I really hope that's the case. I really do enjoy Path of Exile, but at the end of the day, after I've been doing this all day with a mouse, I don't want to do that. I want to do this, not this. I want to do this. So let me do this with Path of Exile. And, you know, I've got a Steam controller. I technically could do this, but I want it to be designed to be fun to do with this. Nintendo! I am almost as much not a Nintendo person as I am not an Xbox person these days. I don't see any reason at all for me to buy a Switch. It just doesn't have the kinds of experiences on it that I want to have, but that could change. One thing that wouldn't really make a difference for my purchasing, but that I would love to see, that I've wanted to see from them since 2015, is a change in their YouTube policies. It doesn't really affect me. I'm not like, I certainly don't have the number of views to get, you know, to earn money from my YouTube channel. And I'm thinking of this less for me and more for other YouTubers. I would just like for them to have a better relationship with the people who are celebrating and enjoying their games and sharing them with other people online. If you're not aware, basically, anything that has any kind of Nintendo type of product as part of the content on YouTube, they are going to claim the right to put ads on that video and get all the money from those ads. But like right now, I don't really want to have annoying ads either pop up at the beginning of one of my videos or like a big long one that's going to play, you know, at the beginning that people are going to be forced to watch. I don't want that for my viewers. I've experimented with ads now and then, but it's really not something that I want to be doing regularly at all. And that's one reason why, even if I were to get a Switch, I don't know that I would do any Nintendo-based content on YouTube. Maybe not so much because of the ads, but because, you know, who knows how mercenary they're going to get or how mean-spirited or, you know, they just make me nervous. I'm even a little bit nervous just to say Nintendo or put Nintendo in my tags for this video. Like, they might come and, you know, get mad at me or something. I know, that's ignorant. They probably wouldn't do that, but they just make me nervous. Stop making YouTubers nervous, Nintendo. Find a way to protect your properties as you have the right to do, but also have good relationships at the same time. Now, what would make me potentially buy a Switch? Well, maybe Zelda Maker. I've been wanting this kind of a game ever since Mario Maker was released. I think that there's so much more potential for a Zelda Maker than there is for a Mario Maker game, so I would love to see that happen. What might make the Switch an insta-buy for me is if they get the Virtual Console and the eShop figured out and get, man, every Nintendo game in history on the eShop, so that the Switch is now a console that will play every Nintendo game ever published. That would be awesome. At the very least, what might make the Switch an insta-buy purchase for me is if they put all of the Symphony of the Night clone Castlevania games available for digital download to play on the Switch. I love Castlevania Symphony of the Night. I love that type of gameplay. I think we need a new name for Metroidvanias, because a lot of people call a game a Metroidvania game when really it's just more like a Super Metroid game. It doesn't have the RPG elements that Castlevania Symphony of the Night has. And they made more games just like that in the Castlevania series for handhelds on the Game Boy Advance and for the Nintendo DS. I can play my Game Boy Advance Castlevania games on a big screen because I have a Retron 5, but I don't have a way to put the DS Castlevania games on the big screen, so I would love to be able to do that. That could be an insta-buy for the Switch for me if they make that happen. I'd also love, for Nintendo's sake, for the industry's sake as a whole, for Nintendo to just kind of get more consumer-friendly. This is kind of connected to the YouTube stuff. And just kind of know their fans more. I feel like there's just a disconnect that Nintendo doesn't really understand or respond really in the way to the degree that I think a lot of people would like them to the desires and the interests of their most passionate fans. If they don't do that, if they can't do that, or if they're unwilling to do that, then actually I'd kind of prefer that they crash and burn and become a software company, so that some of these great IPs that I don't really care about, I'm not a Mario person or a Zelda person, but I know a lot of gamers do, are no longer being held hostage on a console that just doesn't really have any experiences that gamers want apart from these Nintendo-specific intellectual properties. All right, my wishes for the PC gaming conference. In general, I just like no repetition of console announcements that have been made on stages for Sony or Microsoft or Ubisoft or whatever. Just give me new and fresh original announcements, exclusive announcements. I'd also love a focus on indie games or games that have low system requirements, because I do enjoy playing PC games, but I usually play games that are about 10 years old, so because I don't bother keeping my video card updated and stuff like that. And so I'd love to see, you know, them giving some attention to those types of games for PC gamers like me that are not like PC Master Race gamers, but we do like to do some PC gaming now and then. I know I'm asking a lot here. I don't think this is going to happen, but no more AMD conversation ads where they bring the lady out. She has this briefcase. She opens it up and they show the new video card or whatever. Like, ooh. And I know that I'm being totally selfish with this wish list. Okay. I recognize that that's probably really cool for a lot of PC gamers. So on your behalf, I don't wish for them to take that away. But if I'm just speaking purely selfishly, my own wish list, that doesn't interest me at all. It's why I don't often watch the PC conference live, and I just, you know, watch it later, you know, on YouTube or something, and skip that part. And this one comes back to kind of my wish list for Microsoft, but I'd love to see more games. In fact, I'd love to see all PC games going forward. This is a big wish. Recognize that the gamepad is preferred for many, and make their games in such a way that they can be played just as easily and with just as much enjoyment on the gamepad as with keyboard and mouse. I know. You can go ahead and just express whatever you want to express about that idea in the comments. This is my wish list. This is what I want, because again, I do this all day. I don't want to do this during my free time. I want to do this during my free time. So if they could make this possible for every PC game and it be enjoyable and smooth and intuitive, that would rock. And I don't mean for them to take away mouse and keyboard. I don't want to take that away from anybody. I just want to add this. All right, I will wrap up my wish list with just some wishes for games in particular. I would love a BioShock 4. I've been wanting this since 2015. I feel like it's been hibernating for long enough. I don't know if anybody's working on anything with it. Maybe it's been said that nobody's working on it for sure, but I would love to be surprised with an announcement for BioShock 4 or for a Singularity 2. If you haven't played Singularity, when it released, it came out like in the middle of the BioShock series and was called a ripoff of BioShock by many, but now when we have this complete lack of any BioShock games, it's actually a great game to enjoy to kind of scratch that itch. If you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. A year or two ago, one of the devs tweeted, going back to Katorga 12, which is the name of the island that Singularity takes place on, and I thought there would be some kind of E3 announcement or something. There's been no word to my knowledge since then. I would love to get an announcement that Singularity 2 is coming. I'd love a Justice League action RPG in like open world, like open city with a single player focus. So like a Justice League DC Universe game in like the Saints Row game engine. Oh man, there's so much potential there. I feel like, you know, as I watch these Injustice videos of like the story for Injustice and Injustice 2, I'm like, wow, they got these great interesting costume designs and they got these great voice actors and they got this interesting story. You know, I feel like, oh, isn't that kind of being wasted on a fighting game? Don't be mad at me. I'm an RPG player. I don't like fighting games. So I would love to get those artists and those writers and those voice actors involved in creating a story for an open world DC Universe single player action RPG. Oh my gosh! I'd like a new Snowblind action RPG. Now, Snowblind is a studio dissolved. I don't think it's been reconstituted in any way, but more of action RPGs in that vein, specifically Diablo clones that don't involve swarming the player with enemies, but instead have fewer enemies on screen, and for combat and interacting, hitting, you know, attacking those enemies, being hit by those enemies is more meaningful on an enemy by enemy basis, instead of just thinking of the enemies as swarms. I mean, it can get to the point when I'm playing Diablo 3 that I almost feel like I'm playing this really fast-paced, real-time strategy game, you know, instead of with like my guy going against these big units that are coming and attacking, instead of fighting individual enemies or two or three enemies at most. I'd love for there to be news that Pillars of Eternity 2 is coming to console. I really enjoyed the first one, but again, not so good. Much better. I would love to see Pillars of Eternity 2 coming to console. PS4 specifically, of course. Bloodstained is basically a clone of the Castlevania Symphony of the Night formula being made by the same person who designed that series of games. And I'd love to get that, a release date for that, and other indie games that mimic that Symphony of the Night formula. And I'd like to get 2017 release dates. That's probably totally unrealistic, but I'd sure like that. Dragon Quest XI is coming out in Japan, I think, at the end of June or July. No word yet on whether or not it's going to be coming out in the U.S. I really want it to be announced at E3 that Dragon Quest XI is coming to the U.S. in the fall at the latest. So October, because again, I would love to play this one for Extra Life. So Dragon Quest XI in the U.S., no later than Extra Life, please. And if you haven't figured it out yet, I'm a big RPG fan, so I would just like more RPGs. I always love to hear about new RPGs, whether they're turn-based, although with turn-based these days, I do like to have some kind of like a timed button press element like the Shadow Hearts games have, you know, to keep me a little bit more engaged and on the edge of my seat. But I love turn-based games. I love open-world RPGs. I love action RPGs, so just give me more RPGs. That'll make me pretty happy. All right, let's look at some of your wishes from those of you on the forums at christiangeekcentral.com. Michael.withers says, if you give me the old 8-bit and 16-bit Koei, I don't know how you say that, games, I'd probably spring for a Switch. I would love to see something like a remake of Uncharted Waters, a high seas age of sail, explore, and trade, and pirate game. They could even use the Napoleon/Empire Total War ships and graphics. That would be cool. Or a Total War version like they had Spartan Total Warrior. Rickster says, do I need to mention Kingdom Hearts 3? He also says, story trailer and release date for Insomniac's Spider-Man, story trailer for the new God of War game, Super Mario Maker for the Switch, information on Square Enix's Avengers game, some good PlayStation VR game, Final Fantasy VII remake info, an Xbox One exclusive that makes me want to get the system. And he says, I'm hoping for a new Tomb Raider game, Fall of the Tomb Raider maybe. And finally, a Spyro the Dragon remake. And Adam Collings says, man, if they did backwards compatibility on PS3 games, I'd almost consider getting a PS4 someday. Of course, given my track record, I'd move up and then they'd announce the PS5, so I'm probably better off just waiting for the PS5. I hold out zero hope they'll implement backwards compatibility of any type, though. Just can't see it happening. Man, Adam, I seriously hope you're wrong. One thing I've found valuable and that's allowed me to enjoy E3 a whole lot more is, despite kind of like celebrating some of my dreams and stuff like that, keeping my expectations in check. I think that's really important because, you know, there's a history of E3 of games being announced that are canceled or not released. I mean, we have the Phantom Dust remake. Ion was a game announced for Microsoft in 2015, and that just kind of disappeared into the ether. Fable Legends, Scalebound, these games just were announced. They were given a lot of attention. Nothing ever happened. There are also games that end up disappointing us despite the hype that E3 gives for them, like Mass Effect Andromeda got mixed reviews from a lot of people. No Man's Sky got a generally negative reaction from reviewers and I think a lot of players. Assassin's Creed Unity launched with a bunch of bugs and stuff, and it just had a rough time. And I Am Setsuna, for my tastes, I thought it was good, but it had a kind of a repetitive visual design and obscured mechanisms in the gameplay. So we just have to, I think, remember E3 is like, it's good for celebrating games, but to not hang our hopes for fun and fulfillment on the promises made at E3. Along the same lines, we might ask, is there anything useful from the Bible that can guide our hopes and even our prayers as we enjoy all the excitement and buzz around E3? And I think definitely. For me, first off, I've found a helpful tip for enjoying E3 biblically is this. There's a fine line between enjoying something immensely and making it an unhealthy priority. You know, we hyperbolically say that we love games, you know, and I'm even getting animated right now talking about it. Part of that is to hopefully hold your interest. Keep watching, keep watching. But keeping ourselves from like genuinely deeply loving them or seeking contentment in them or trying to find our identity in them, if we avoid those things, I think that will save us from a lot of trouble. Getting angry because an entertainment property we enjoy is being mishandled strikes me as a sign that we are too personally invested in that property. We're counting on it to bring us not just pleasure, but fulfillment and contentment. But that kind of fulfillment and contentment is short-lived and usually gives too much credit to the wrong source. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17 in the ESV reads, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and pride in possessions, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. The Greek word for love here means to love dearly or to be contented with. Now, it's great to enjoy our hobbies and our nerdly delights. I mean, after all, everything good in life ultimately has its source in God. Now, sure, there are tons of creative humans involved that should be thanked, but they have their creative abilities because of how God has gifted them or inspired them through his creation of the world or other people that that he's created. God is the ultimate source of the things, the created things that we enjoy. So if we dearly love our hobbies, if we cling to them and view them as our source of contentment in life or rescue from the things in life that are bothering us, then we are out of connection with a love relationship with God at that point. By contrast, the more we love God, the more we'll constantly be reminded that, you know what, this world falls infinitely short of who he is and that we really shouldn't expect that much from it. And that puts us in a position to enjoy entertainment when it's fun and not get upset when it's not. It's also important and right that we give credit to God for all the amazing things he has made possible in the world of entertainment, and yet without obsessing over those things themselves. Paul teaches that we shouldn't have these intense, self-centered desires for possessions, and that this is actually the same as worshiping something in place of God. And we can see more about that in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 3 through 5. When we fixate our passions and obsessions on something created instead of our Creator, it's kind of like being treated to dinner at someone's house and telling your hamburger, "Oh, you're so delicious. I love you. I love you so much." And while eating it, and then never even saying thank you to the person who made the burger for you. James 1:15 in the ESV reads, "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change." The things that we enjoy will all fade. You've probably had that experience of getting really excited about something, and then the experience ends, or it doesn't live up to your expectations. So everything that we enjoy, it doesn't last, it fades. But God does not change. He is the ultimate source of creativity and excellence. So both before and after complimenting the work of humans, as we should be crediting and loving him more than anyone else for the entertainment that we enjoy. So as you see things from E3 that just kind of get you excited or blow your mind, allow yourself to quickly take your thoughts to God and just think, "Wow, God, you are amazing that you could orchestrate humanity in such a way that something like this is possible." That's it for me for right now. Have fun watching all the E3 coverage on the web. And then I hope you'll come back here to get my reactions and to share yours as well.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. And lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
In this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language that we can often take for granted, digging into history and languages, when I'm able to speak my own language, to try and get at the heart of the text, so hopefully you and I can see and then apply at least some of what God has for us in these words today. I'm not formally trained in Scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth, and I hope you'll do that with me. It's really something we can all do in this fantastic age of the internet. And you know, on that note, I should say that, you know, just because it's spit out from the result of a Google search doesn't mean it's reliable. That's not what I mean when I say that, you know, we can all dig into Scripture and learn what is true about it from doing, you know, a Google search. I think it's really important to understand the resources you're taking advantage of and where they are coming from in terms of how they view the Bible, in terms of how they approach seeking truth, and just making sure that they're a credible source. So I do think that's really important. But even with that, you know, restriction we impose on ourselves, it is amazing the kinds of fantastic high caliber resources that are available for free. And more than that, the fantastic resources above and beyond that are even, I think, even stronger that you can get when you set aside some money for that. So I would highly recommend, if you've never considered doing that before, to just set aside a little bit of money here and there so that maybe at the end of the year you can afford to pick up, you know, it's like a $50 commentary or a $50 reference resource of some kind that will really help you when you find yourself looking at the Bible and you're like, this is weird. because some really good resources can help us go from this is weird to wow, this is amazing and so relevant to what I'm experiencing this week. And that's where we want to be, I think, when we open up our Bibles. So, and that's certainly my aim as I kind of take this journey through the Bible myself and invite you guys to listen in on my thoughts and as we do this. So let's get back into that then. We're in Ephesians chapter 4, and we're looking at verses 17 through 19. In the ESV, it reads, "Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do, in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart. They have become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity." All right, so we'll take this as we usually do, verse by verse here, looking first at verse 17, which again says, "Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds." Although this letter was written to a community consisting of both Jews and Gentiles, Paul doesn't think of them in those ethnic categories, but as a new kind of man, a single body created by joining these two people groups in Christ. And I think we see that in chapter 2, verses 11 through 22, and also in chapter 4, verses 1 through 16. So it makes sense, while speaking partially to Gentiles, that he would tell them not to live like Gentiles do. It's a reminder to them, and I think to us, that despite the numerous backgrounds represented in the mix, all believers in Christ are a single body, unified by the redemption and adoption made possible by Jesus. Another reminder from this verse is that because Paul warns believers not to live like unbelievers, it means that believers can potentially live like unbelievers. These descriptions of human rebellion and brokenness are all things that Christians can and do fall into. The Greek word for futility, as it is used here, means perverseness, depravity, and good for nothing. So this futility of mind lacks purpose and is focused on wasteful, short-term pleasure that lies outside of God's will. Verse 18 says, "They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart." Unbelievers and stagnant or wandering Christians are darkened in their understanding, meaning in the Greek that they are blinded to what is true. This blindness separates them from the life of God, which in the Greek, that phrase refers to the vital, full, active, and vigorous life God intends and enables. The immediate cause of this state is ignorance, but the deeper cause is a hardness of heart that results in ignorance. This expression describes a stubborn mind that refuses to change its course. It was used of the Pharisees when they refused to budge in their view despite its demonstrably obvious flaws. You can see Mark chapter 3, verses 1 through 6 for that. Verse 19 says, "They have become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity." Paul seemingly continues the hardening metaphor by describing those in this state as callous, but in the Greek, this actually has to do with a lack of feeling. In the same way that our nerve endings don't reach up to our calluses, and so they're protected from pain. In fact, this expression specifically refers to an inability to feel grief or pain. The person who is callous in this sense feels no grief or pain associated with their sin. They've turned off that sensor to go about doing whatever they want to do. The Greek word for sensuality here is not always used to refer to sexual sin, but leans a bit in that direction. Two of my commonly used commentaries, the IVP Bible Background Commentary from InterVarsity Press, and the Expositor's Bible Commentary by Zondervan Publishing, as well as Thayer's Greek Lexicon, treat it with a sexual connotation in this verse. Although their reasoning, I gotta be honest, isn't clear to me. Maybe it's because of its pairing with the Greek word for impurity, which has a physical, often sexual connotation as well. It was also a common Greek practice at the time this letter was written for older men to molest young boys as a way of ushering them into manhood, if you can believe that. This practice, along with the sexual practices of Greek temples, could be the reason for assuming the specifically sexual nature of this quote-unquote Gentile sin. In summary, this verse reveals that when we deaden ourselves to the sting of sin that we are meant to feel, we have nothing to prevent us from just making our lives primarily about pursuing as much pleasure as we can. I've talked to people before who have said that, you know, that they can feel the difference between good and evil, and this verse I think indicates to us that, you know, we can't count on that. We can't count on that. Sometimes we can find ourselves living in sin, and not feeling that like it's a problem for us. Well, that doesn't cause any problems. Well, we might not feel like, you know, watching Game of Thrones or whatever is causing a problem for us, or it's, you know, it's, we don't feel guilt or we don't feel shame in those moments. But that doesn't mean that you know, the violent content or the sexual content or whatever isn't still having an effect on us. So we've got to, I think, judge those things based on something other than what we are feeling. So what's in all this for geeks? Well, I suppose that we're stuck around here with the name Christian Geek Central. I've never been super sold on it. Honestly, it was largely chosen for its usefulness in search engines and its succinct description of what this animal is that I'm trying to do here with your help. But despite its usefulness as a shorthand identifier, I don't want to encourage us to think of ourselves as Christian geeks. That doesn't mean I'm going to stop using that phrase, because it's useful in many ways. But I don't want to encourage us to think of ourselves, identify ourselves, you know, at the end of the day, as Christian geeks, where Christian is an adjective that modifies the core noun, the core identity of geek. I'm a geek, but I'm a Christian geek, you know. I really don't want us to think of ourselves that way. I don't think we should as believers in Christ. Geek Christian doesn't roll off the tongue as easily, but it's a bit closer to the mark. Our identity is not geek. We are Christians, or as the word literally means, little Christs, these walking and talking imitations of Jesus in miniature who actually have his righteous record in place of our own. And because of this, we shouldn't just blend in with other geeks, identifying with them in the same way that they identify as geeks, and living the way that they live and seeing life the way that they do. As geek culture becomes more solitary and isolated, you and I should be growing in our investment in people. As geeks become outraged at the treatment of their favorite fictional properties, we should just kind of sigh, shrug, and remember the things that really matter at the end of the day. As geeks become more obsessed with possessions and a sense of kind of geek cred, we should see our possessions in terms of how they serve Jesus and seek out relational cred with the people in our lives. As someone who really enjoys listening to geek media that celebrates or criticizes entertainment, I can tell you that the messages promoting materialism, entitlement, and the dismissal of truth are ever present, even if they are subtle or often unintended. And in high enough doses with my brain on autopilot, I can get caught up in materialism and entitlement just as much as anybody else. Sometimes there's a fine line between enjoyment of hobbies and pursuit of them for fulfillment. It doesn't take much time off the rails before we can unintentionally become unaware and insensitive to the hurt our actions, neglect, and wrong priorities cause to others. You can call it social awkwardness or callousness. Whatever the cause, we find ourselves oblivious and numb to the effects of our sin on us and on others. And since this passage arguably has an emphasis on sexual sin, I don't want to neglect it. An unfortunate quality in many of us geeks is a lack of impulse control when it comes to pleasure that can easily carry over into our greatest potential source of physical pleasure, our sexuality. And this can lead us to unbiblically enjoy sex outside of the marriage relationship, which is said to be unbiblical and something we should avoid. We see that in 1 Corinthians 7, 8 through 9. Or it can lead us to engage in a thought life that makes other people objects for our pleasure, which I think is what's being taught against in Matthew 5, 27, and 28. We can reach the point in either sin where we don't feel like anything is wrong with what we're doing. You know, we can quote-unquote have a peace about it. But it's a peace that is inconsistent with the truth when examined and exposed in the light. It's a peace based on the unfeeling hardness of heart being warned about here. And again, this hardness of heart, often we associate it with like this kind of bitterness and this anger. That's not necessarily what's being talked about here. Sometimes it's just this deadness, this lack of feeling, because we at some point started diverting away from the truth about some specific issue that we didn't want to really think about or have to confront in ourselves. When we reach these kinds of hardened, callous states, we can find ourselves at some point wondering where God is in some area of our life. Where is God? You know, why am I not experiencing the kind of vitality, the kind of transformation, the freedom that we're supposed to have that the Bible talks about? Where is that? Why am I not experiencing that? And these verses tell us that becoming deadened to our sin is the reason the life of God, which brings about vitality, transformation, and freedom, is absent from our experience. Recognizing our identity, getting real enough with ourselves to admit our mess, and seeing God's perfection enough to feel the sting of our sin and turn away from it. That's how we avoid being absorbed into the world, how we experience the relief of God's grace, and how we keep ourselves available for the free and empowered life God wants to give us. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. Tell me what should we keep, what should we change, or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on. We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and as useful as we can, but I've got to hear from you to do that. You can send an email or audio file recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. All right, let me just briefly pray for some stuff that's on our mind, on my mind, and our in the biblical Pauline sense, maybe, on my mind, and that I've, you know, read about recently in the prayer request section of the forums. Holy Spirit, we are just broken people, and sometimes we know what's wrong with us, and sometimes we don't even see it. And we pray that you would reveal sin to us. And in that process, remind us of the tireless grace of Jesus so that we can confront that sin. I pray for just the tension that sin causes in our relationships that that we contribute to and that we don't contribute to, or that we contribute maybe in our minds just a teeny tiny bit to. Would you just reveal to us the role that we're playing in conflict and tension in our relationships with our family members. No matter what percentage we are contributing, we pray that we would deal with that, that you would humble us and help us to deal with that. Pray also for medical treatment that we may be in need of, or counseling that we may be in need of, and the people that are helping us, we pray that you would give them, gave myself a little paper cut there. We pray that you would give us give those who are caring for us the wisdom to understand what it is that we need and what the best course of action is to bring about healing and correction and just a life that's going to be more positioned to experience the kind of freedom that you want us to have, and to engage in the things in life you want us to engage in. So would you make us open to the evaluations of professionals? And would you give them wisdom at the same time to evaluate correctly? And it's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen. All right. Well, just as a reminder, guys, if you'd like some help finding a local Bible-teaching, truth-seeking church in your area, please email me anytime at paeter@spiritblade.com. I'd be happy to help you with that. I want to thank Katja from the Netherlands for her audiobook review contribution this week. Thank you very much, Katja. Stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, I'll be sharing some Summer of Free Goodness as we focus on free movies. Free geek movies that are available for you to check out online. Then I'm also going to be sharing what's been blipping on the Christian geek radar. And I plan on also reviewing The Mummy. We'll see what that animal is going to be like and what Universal's monster movie universe has in store for us. Until then, check out spiritblade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you guys. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth. If you're curious, I was just, my phone during that prayer was buzzing, and I reached into my pocket to turn it off. It wasn't quite a paper cut. I had a pack of gum in my pocket, and like a little edge of it, when I shoved my hand into my pocket, it went right under my fingernail. And so paper cut wasn't quite the right thing, but dang, that smarts.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampton with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Something's coming through the wormhole.
Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
And that was Visionary. Pretty good episode. Chief O'Brien keeps peeking 5 hours ahead in the future and solving problems he sees.
Yeah, I really like this one. I have not seen it in a long, long time. And so most of the plot twists were, like, new to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very enjoyable episode.
By the way, I pretty much summed up the entire episode. Everything beyond that is just details. That really is. He gets a magic jolt of time fart juice or whatever, and he just starts zapping ahead 5 hours at a time, always near himself, seeing the future.
He's been zapped with 5 hour energy.
Wow.
That just occurred to me. Oh my god. I'm sorry. Continue.
You really like your own jokes there, don't you? But yeah, one of the things I really liked about this episode is no one was stupid. You know how usually in this kind of story, where someone's doing something unexpected, and the first time it happens, people are just saying, oh, you just imagined it, oh, you're making it up, and it happens again, and say, oh, that was just a dream, and they just go on forever, and it's aggravating.
And they have to do the grab the person by the shirt, you have to believe me, man!
And then they act stupid because they say it in the most gibberingly insane way possible. The fairies are sprouting on my acorns! And it's like, we don't have any of that. They initially think it's a hallucination because O'Brien got zapped with the fart. But after that, it's like, once it's proven that what he saw came true, then it's like, oh, well, I guess you're beaten. Then they do a scan, and they sense magic in the air. And they say, oh, well, you know, I guess you are going ahead. And they just go on from there. And when he sees a danger, they take it seriously, and they deal with it wisely. And, you know, and because they're watching it, they see what happens. And, they don't go to this fatalism, like, what must be. It's like, they stop things from happening. And then another problem comes up in the future, because there are Romulans involved, so of course there's problems within problems within problems. So that's just the Romulan nature.
Now the one thing that we both did think was a little stupid was at one point O'Brien jumps forward and sees his own body on Bashir's autopsy table, and Bashir comes in and very casually is like, "Oh, hello, Chief, you're here. How are you doing? Let me very slowly converse with you
eventually
get around to telling you how you died."
And mind you, by this time, he's already jumped ahead 3 or 4 times, and each time he, like, jumps ahead, spends, like, about 10 seconds, and then just without any warning, he's gone and he's back in the past. And so O'Brien was sitting there just chatting with him, just shooting it up, and it was very tragic. Instead of just saying, "Oh, it's you, listen, do this, remember this, da-da-da-da-da.
Tell me to look for this in your brain,
yeah,
or you're gonna die." Those should have been the words you led with, Bashir.
I mean, I like that Bashir was like, "Oh, what's happening?" He just, it was a little started like, "Oh,
but
okay."
But he was just a little too casual for my taste.
Well, yeah, for me it was just how slow-paced he was.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of contrivance because he always sticks around exactly as long as it takes to be dramatic, and there's a lot of inconsistency on, like, the number of times and how far and all this, you know, and then near the end when he like jumps himself artificially forward, and yet he sees himself in bed. So I'm not sure how this alternate timeline works, that he jumped forward, and I guess he, like, that didn't work, and he then went back to bed and ran his normal life.
Well, and also, apparently, at some point between those last two jumps, not only knowing that things were in danger did he take a nap, but he also went and screwed around in Quarks for a while.
Yeah. I suppose maybe you can say that he was still on the original timeline of when he thought everything was good, and then he had jumped 5 hours, but when he came back, it was still on that. I don't know. It's, you know, it's time travel. It always gets confusing. And, you know, you can't think about it too much, and that's unfortunate.
That doesn't make sense, because then he would have died twice at the same time.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, is they established very quick, he changes things. Even the very first time when he just saw something happen. When it happened the second time, when it happened in quote-unquote real time,
it was already different.
Yeah, they were seeing O'Brien over there, it was like, whoa, what the... Whereas originally, no one even noticed him until right when he was beaming back, so... Every single time it went differently than when he skipped forward and watched it. So, yeah, there's a little bit of, you gotta, I hate to say turn off your brain, because it's not a stupid episode, but there's some inconsistencies that you have to ignore.
It's a neat concept, but it's got a few holes.
But the holes are there for the sake of making the story engaging and interesting. And so I think it's forgivable for that, rather than so we can get away with pointless, you know, it's not so we can have an action scene or something like that. It's because this needs to make sense, and we need to have this moment happen and all that. Not much to say, really. There's no subplot to it. Well, I guess there's a little bit of one, because the Romulans are here. They're investigating what happened at the beginning of the season when they took the Defiant and met the Founders and all that. And so we see that they're being rude and brusque and everything. And especially with Odo and Kira, they're getting especially grilled. And Kira gets very offended at the idea that Odo would have a romantic interest in her. Which, as we've seen, he clearly does.
I love Sisko asks Kira to please remember that the Romulans are their allies in this endeavor and be diplomatic when she's being debriefed. Smash cut to Kira yelling at them and telling them they're idiots.
That's worthy of Gilligan's Island right there. Those poor people. But,
indeed.
Yes, definitely this is a good episode to catch, and it's one of those I listed before. It's a good episode if you've never seen Deep Space Nine. Because there's really nothing you need to know about the show beforehand. So if you haven't been watching until now, this would be a good jumping on point. We'll see you next time. I don't know what the episode is, so we'll just see you with the next episode. Bye for now.